Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Chapter 29 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 29. How I Heard English Spoken Here. I suppose I must have dropped asleep sometime, but it seemed to me that I was lying awake watching for the daylight, which seemed as if it would never come. Then I dropped soundly asleep and slept some hours, for when I opened my eyes with a start, there was one of the blacks leaning over me with some cords in his hands, with which he seemed to be about to bind me. But a shout outside took his attention, and he went out, leaving me trembling with anxiety and crushing the note in my hand. It was broad daylight with brilliant sunshine without, but my prison was windowless, and where I lay was in the shadow, save where here and there a pencil of light shone through the palm leaf thatch and made a glowing spot upon the floor. Every moment I expected to see my guard back again, or I might be interrupted, I knew, by the coming of someone with food. I dared not then attempt to read for some time, since it seemed like too great a risk of losing words that were inexpressibly precious. At last all seemed so still but the buzz and hum of distant voices that I determined to venture, and undoing my hot hand I unfolded the little scrap of paper, upon which, written closely but clearly, were the following words: "As we are so near a village of the blacks, and you have not returned, I have concluded you have been made a prisoner. Gyp found your scent and went off, returning after many hours' absence, so I write these lines to bid you be of good heart, for we shall try by stratagem to get you away." Then there was this, evidently written the next day: "Gyp has been again, and brought back the above lines which I tied to his collar. If you get them, tie something to the dog's collar to show you are alive and well. Poor Jimmy went in search of you, but has not yet returned." Tie something to the dog's collar to show you're alive and well, I said to myself over and over again, as I carefully secreted the scrap of paper. A needless task, as, if it had been seen, no one would have paid any heed to it. And I have tied something to the dog's collar, and they will come, the doctor and Jack Penny with the blacks, tonight to try to save me, and I shall escape. I stopped here, for the words seemed wild and foolish. How could they rescue me? And besides, ought I not to feel glad that I was here among the natives of the island? What better position could I be in for gaining information about my father? I lay thinking like this for long, and every hour it seemed that my injured head and my cut wrists and ankles were healing. The confused feeling had passed away, leaving nothing but stiffness and soreness, while the message I had received gave me what I wanted worst, hope. I did not see Jimmy that day, for he was not brought out, neither was I taken to the tree. But I saw that the savage who brought me food had a double quantity, and to prove that some of it was meant for my fellow prisoner, I soon afterwards heard him shout, "Mass Joe, come have Nana, come have plantain Nana." This he repeated until I uttered a long, low whistle, one which he had heard me use scores of times, and to which he replied. An hour after he whistled again, but I could not reply, for three or four of the blacks were in the hut with me, evidently for no other purpose than to watch. That night I lay awake, trembling and anxious. I wanted to have something ready to send back by the dog when it came at night, but try how I would, I could contrive nothing. I had no pencil or paper, no point of any kind to scratch a few words on a piece of bark, no piece of bark if I had had a point. As it happened, though I lay awake, the dog did not come, and when the morning came, though I was restless and feverish, I was more at rest in my mind, for I thought I saw my way to communicate a word or two with the doctor. I was unbound now, and therefore had no difficulty in moving about the hut, from whose low roof, after a good deal of trying, I at last obtained a piece of palm leaf that seemed likely to suit my purpose. This done, my need was a point of some kind, a pin, a nail, the tongue of a buckle, a hard, sharp piece of wood, and I had neither. But I had hope. Several different blacks had taken their places at the door of my hut, and I was waiting patiently for the one to return who sat there carving his waddy handle. When he came, I hoped by some stratagem to get hold of the sharp bit of flint to scratch my palm leaf. Fortunately, towards midday this man came, and after a good look at me where I lay, he stuck his spear in the earth and squatted down, took out his flint and waddy, and began once more to laboriously cut zigzag lines that formed the ornamentation. I lay there hungrily watching him hour after hour, vainly trying to think out some plan, and when I was quite in despair, the black boy, whom I had not seen for many hours, came sauntering up in an indifferent way to stand talking to my guard for some minutes, and then entered the hut to stand looking down at me. I was puzzled about that boy, for at times I thought him friendly, at others disposed to treat me as an enemy. But my puzzled state was at an end, for as soon as I began to make signs he watched me eagerly and tried to comprehend. I had hard work to make him understand by pointing to the savage outside, then pretending to hack at my finger as if carving it. Jimmy would have understood in a moment, but it was some time before the boy saw what I meant. Then his face lit up, and he slowly sauntered away as if in the most careless of moods, poising his spear and throwing it at trees, stooping, leaping, playing at being a warrior of his tribe, so it seemed to me, till he disappeared among the trees. The sun was sinking low, but he did not return. I saw him pass by with the tall painted warrior, then go out of sight. My food had been given me, but I had not seen Jimmy, though we had corresponded together by making a few shrill parrot-like whistles. Night would soon be upon me once again, and when Gyp came, if he did come, I should not be ready. I was just thinking like this when there was a slight tap beside me, and turning quickly, I saw a sharp-pointed piece of stone upon the beaten earth floor, and as I reached out my hand to pick it up, a piece of white wood struck me on the hand, making a sharp metallic sound. I felt that there was danger, and half threw myself over my treasures, looking dreamily out at the entrance and remaining motionless, as my guard entered to stare round suspiciously, eyeing me all over, then going slowly back. I breathed more freely, and was thinking as I saw him settle down that I might at any time begin to try and carve a word or two, and in this mind I was about to take the piece of wood from beneath me, when the savage swung himself round and sprang into the hut in a couple of bounds. He had meant to surprise me if I had been engaged upon any plan of escape, but finding me perfectly motionless, he merely laughed and went back. Directly after, another savage came up and took his place, and I eagerly began my task. Very easy it sounds to carve a few letters on a piece of wood, but how hard I found it before I managed to roughly cut the words "all well," having selected these because they were composed of straight lines, which mine were not. Still, I hoped that the doctor would make them out, and I hid my piece of flint and my wooden note, and waited, meaning to keep awake till the dog came. But I had been awake all the previous night, and I fell fast asleep till Gyp came and roused me by scratching at my chest, when in a dreamy, confused way I found and took something from the dog's collar and tied my note in its place, falling asleep directly after from sheer exhaustion. It was broad daylight when I awoke, and my first thought was of my message, when, thrusting my hand into my breast, a curious sensation of misery came over me as my hand came in contact with a piece of wood, and it seemed that I had been dreaming and the dog had not come. I drew out the flat piece of white wood, but it was not mine. The doctor, probably having no paper, had hit upon the same plan as I. His words were few. "Be on the alert. We shall come some night." I thrust the wooden label beneath the dust of the floor and scraped some more earth over it, and already saw myself at liberty, and in the joy of my heart I uttered a long parrot-like whistle, but it was not answered. I whistled again, but there was no reply, and though I kept on making signals for quite an hour, no response came, and the joyousness began to fade out of my breast. Twice over that morning I saw the tall savage who was so diabolically painted and tattooed go by, and once I thought he looked very hard at my hut, but he soon passed out of my sight, leaving me wondering whether he was the chief, from his being so much alone, and the curious way in which all the people seemed to get out of his path. Once or twice he came near enough for me to see him better, and I noticed that he walked with his eyes fixed upon the ground in a dreamy way, full of dignity, and I felt certain now that he must be the king of these people. The next day came, and I saw him again in the midst of quite a crowd, who had borne one of their number into the middle of the enclosure of huts, and this time I saw the tall, strange-looking savage go slowly down upon his knees, and soon after rise and motion with his hands, when everyone but the boy fell back. He alone knelt down on one side of what was evidently an injured man. The blacks kept their distance religiously till the painted savage signed to them once more, when they ran forward, and four of their number lifted the prostrate figure carefully and carried it into a hut. "I was right," I said to myself, with a feeling of satisfaction. "I was right the first time. It is the doctor, and he ought to have come to my help when I was so bad." 2 days, 3 days passed, during which I lay and watched the birds that flitted by, saw the people as they came and went, and from time to time uttered a signal whistle. But this had to be stopped, for on the afternoon of the third day a very tall savage entered hurriedly in the... in company with my guard and a half a dozen more, and by signs informed me that if I made signals again, my life would be taken. It was very easy to understand, for spears were pointed at me and war clubs tapped me, not very lightly, upon the head. As soon as I was left alone, I sat thinking, and before long came to the conclusion that this was probably the reason why I had not heard any signal from Jimmy, who had perhaps been obstinate and consequently had been treated with greater severity. I longed for the night to come when I might have some fresh message from the doctor, but somehow I could not keep awake, anxious as I was, and I was sleeping soundly when a touch woke me with a start. I threw up my hands to catch Gyp by the collar, but to my consternation I touched a hand and arm in the darkness, and there was something so peculiar in the touch, my hand seeming to rest on raised lines of paint, that I turned cold, for I knew that one of the savages was bending over me, and I felt it must mean that my time had come. I should have called out, but a hand was laid over my lips, and an arm pressed my chest as a voice whispered in good English, "Run! Escape! You can't stay here!" "Who is it?" I whispered back, trembling with excitement. "I know," I added quickly, "you're the tall savage, the doctor." "Yes, yes," he said in a low, dreamy tone, "the tall savage, yes, tall savage." "But you're an Englishman," I panted, with a terrible thought, half painful, half filled with hope, flashed through my brain. "Englishman, yes, Englishman, before I was here, before I was ill. Come, quick, escape for your life. Go!" "And you?" He was silent. So silent I put out my hands and touched him, to make sure he had not gone, and I found that he was resting his head upon my hands. "Will you go with me to my friends?" I said, trembling still, for the thought that had come to me was gaining strength. "Friends," he said softly, "friends. Yes. Yes, I had friends before I came. Before I came." He said this in a curious, dreamy tone, and I forced the idea back. It was impossible, but at the same time my heart leapt for joy. Here was an Englishman dwelling among the savages, a prisoner, or one who had taken up this life willingly, and if he could dwell among them, so could my father, who must be somewhere here. "Tell me," I began, but he laid his hands upon my lips. "Not a sound," he said. "The people sleep lightly. Come with me." He took my hand in his and led me out boldly past a black who was lying a short distance from my hut, and then right across the broad opening surrounded by the natives' dwellings, and then through a grove of trees to a large hut standing by itself. He pressed my hand hard and led me through the wide opening into what seemed to be a blacker darkness, which did not, however, trouble him, for he stepped out boldly, and then I heard a muttering growl which I recognized directly. "Hush, Jimmy," I whispered, throwing myself upon my knees. "Don't speak." "Jimmy not a go to speak 'em," he said softly. "Mass Joe come a top." "Go," said my companion. "Go quick. I want to help. My head. Help." There was another pause, and on stretching out my hand I found that my guide was pressing his to his forehead once again. "He has lived this savage life so long that he cannot think," I felt, as taking his hand I led him to the opening, through which he passed in silence, and with Jimmy walking close behind he led us between a couple more huts, then for a good hour between tall trees so close together that we threaded our way with difficulty. My companion did not speak, and at last the silence grew so painful that I asked him how long it would be before daybreak. "Hush," he said. "Listen. They have found out." He finished in an excited way, repeating hastily some native words before stooping to listen, when, to my dismay, plainly enough in the silence of the night, came the angry murmur of voices, and this probably meant pursuit, perhaps capture, and then death. End of chapter 29. How I Heard English Spoken Here. Ch- Chapter 30 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 30, How I Talked with My New Friend. As I heard the sound of the pursuit, a horrible sensation of dread came over me. I felt that we must be taken, and, in addition, vague ideas of trouble and bloodshed floated through my brain, with memories of the fight in the gorge, and I shuddered at the idea of there being more people slain. The effect was different upon Jimmy, the distant cries seeming to excite him. He stopped every now and then to jump from the ground and strike the nearest tree a tremendous blow with a waddy he had obtained from our guide. The latter checked him, though, laying a hand upon his arm, as he said to me after listening intently, "You don't want to fight. These people are too strong. You must escape." "But will you come with us?" I said once more, with a vague fancy coming back that this was he whom I sought, but terribly changed. He said something in reply in the savage tongue, stopped, and then went on. "I forget. I don't know. I am the doctor. A savage. What did you say?" "Come with us," I whispered, and he bent his head in the dark, but my words seemed to have no effect upon him. One idea seeming to be all that he could retain, for he hurried me on, grasping my arm tightly and then loosed it, and went on in front. Jimmy took his place, gripping my arm in turn, and whispering, showed his power of observation by saying, "Much good him, no black fellow, talk like Mass Joe sometime. Jimmy think a Mass Joe fada got dust in head, don't know, no." "Oh, no, impossible, Jimmy," I whispered back with emotion. "It cannot be my father." "No, fader. All em white fella got mud in head. Can't see, can't know, no. No Mass Joe fader?" "No, I'm sure it is not." "Then white fellow. No black fellow. Tupid. Don't know at all. No find wallaby and hole. No find honey. No kedge fist. Stupid white fellow, all the same, mud in em head." "He seems strange in his head," I said. "Yes, is mad. No wash em head clean. Can't tink straight up and downs like em Jimmy." "But he is saving us," I said, "taking us to our friends." "Jimmy not know. Jimmy tink doctor somewhere right long, big hill. Give black white fellow topper, make em tink more." No, I whispered, for he had grasped his waddy, and was about to clear our guide's musty brain with this rough and ready way. "Be quiet and follow him." Just then our guide stopped and let me go to his side. "Fever, my head," he said softly, and as if apologizing, "can't think." "But you will come with us," I said. "My friend the doctor will help you. You shall help us. You must not go back to that degraded life." "Doctor," he said, as if he had only caught that word. "Yes, the doctor. Can't leave the people. Can't leave him." "Him?" I said. "That boy?" "Hush, come faster," for there were shouts and cries behind, and he hurried us along for some distance, talking rapidly to me all the while in the savage's tongue, and apparently under the impression that I understood every word, though it was only now and then that I caught his meaning, and then it was because they were English words. After catching a few of these, I became aware, or rather guessed, that he was telling me the story of his captivity among these people, and I tried eagerly to get him to speak English, but he did not seem to heed me, going on rapidly, and apparently bent on getting us away. I caught such words as fever, prisoner, my head, years, misery, despair, always, savage. Doctor. But only in the midst of a long, excited account which he said more to himself. I was at last paying little heed to him when two words stood out clear and distinctly from the darkness of his savage speech, words that sent a spasm through me and made me catch at his arm and try to speak, but only to emit a few gasping utterances as he bent down to me, staring as if in wonder. The words were, "Fellow prisoner," and they made me stop short, for I felt that I had really and providentially hit on the right place after all, and that there could be only one man likely to be a fellow prisoner, and that my poor father. It was impossible to flee farther, I felt, and leave him whom I had come to seek behind. Then common sense stepped in and made me know that it was folly to stay, while Jimmy supplemented these thoughts by saying, "Black fellow come along fast. Mass Joe no gun, no powder pop, no chopper, no knife, no fight works tall." "Where is he?" I said excitedly as I held the arm of our guide. "Blacks, coming after us." He talked on rapidly in the savage tongue, and I uttered a groan of despair. "What 'em say, Mass Joe?" whispered Jimmy excitedly. "Talk, talk, Paul Parrot can't say no what 'em say. Come along, run way fast. Fight nutter time," he added. "Black fellow come along." He caught my arm, and following our guide, we hurried on through the darkness, which was so dense that if it had not been for the wonderful eyesight of my black companion, a faculty which seemed to have been acquired or shared by our guide, I should have struck full against the trunk of some tree. As it was, I met with a few unpleasant blows on arm or shoulder, though the excitement of our flight was too great for me to heed them then. I was in despair and torn by conflicting emotions, joy at escaping and at having reached the goal I had set up, misery at having to leave it behind just when I had found the light. It might have been foolish, seeing how much better I could serve him by being free, but I felt ready to hurry back and share my father's captivity, for I felt assured that it must be he of whom our guide spoke. We were hurrying on all this time entirely under the guidance of the strange being who had set us free, but not without protests from the black, who was growing jealous of our guide, and who kept on whispering, "No go no farer, Mass Joe. Jimmy fine a doctor, and Mass Jack Penny. Hi, come along Jimmy now." He was just repeating this in my ear when we were hurrying on faster, for the sounds of our pursuers came clear upon the wind, when our guide stopped short and fell back a few paces as a low angry growl saluted him from the darkness in front, and he said something sharply to us in the native tongue. His words evidently meant "fall back," but I had recognized that growl. "Gyp!" I cried, and the growling changed to a whining cry of joy, and in an instant the dog was leaping up at my face, playfully biting at my hands, then darting at Jimmy, he began the same welcoming demonstrations upon the black. "Mass Joe, Mass Joe, he go eat up black fellow. Top him away, top him away." "It's only his play, Jimmy," I said. "Him eat piece Jimmy all up leg 'em," cried the black. "Here, Gyp," I cried, as the dog stopped his whining cry of pleasure, but growled once more. "Here," I said, "this is a friend. Pat his head, sir, and where is he, Jimmy?" "Black white fellow, Mass Joe?" "Yes, yes, where is he?" "Gone long utter way. Run back, fast, fast. 'Fraid of Gyp. Gyp sent him away." "Stop him! Run after him! He must not go," I cried. I stopped, for there was a low piping whistle like the cry of a Blue Mountain parrot back at home. "Jack Penny," I gasped, and I answered the call. "Iss, yes, Mass Jack Penny," cried Jimmy, and Gyp made a bound from my side into the darkness, leaving us alone. We heard the crash and rustle of the underbrush as the dog tore off, and I was about to follow, but I could not stir, feeling that if I waited our guide might return, when in the midst of my indecision the whistle was repeated, and this time Jimmy answered. Then there was more rustling, the dog came panting back, and as the rustling continued there came out of the darkness a sound that made my heart leap. It was only my name, softly uttered, apparently close at hand, and I made a bound in the direction, but only to fall back half stunned, for I had struck myself full against a tree. I just remember falling and being caught by someone, and then I felt sick, and the darkness seemed filled with lights. But these soon died out, and I was listening to a familiar voice that came, it appeared, from a long way off. Then it came nearer and nearer, and the words seemed to be breathed upon my face. "Only a bit stunned," it said, and then I gasped out the one word, "Doctor!" "My dear Joe," came back, and, well, it was in the dark, and we were not ashamed. The doctor hugged me to his heart, as if I had been his brother whom he had found. End of chapter 30. How I Talked with My New Friend. Chapter 31 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 31. How We Made Further Plans. "Why, Joe, my lad," he said at last, in a voice I did not recognize, it was so full of emotion, "you've driven me half wild. How could you get in such a fix?"
"Jimmy get in big fix," said an ill-used voice. "Nobody glad to see Jimmy."
"I'm glad to feel you," drawled a well-known voice. "I can't see you. How are you, Joe Carstairs? Where have you been?"
"Jack, old fella, I'm glad," I cried, and I grasped his hands.
"That will do," said the doctor sternly. "Are the savages after you, Joe?"
"Yes, in full pursuit, I think," I said, "but my guide, I can't leave him."
"Your guide? Where is he?"
"I don't know. He was here just now. He brought us here."
"Jimmy, Jimmy, say 'em goes back along," said the black. "He no top. Big fright. Gyp bite 'em."
"One of the blacks, Joe?" said the doctor.
"No, no," I said, so excited I could hardly speak coherently. "A white man, a prisoner among the blacks, like a savage, but..."
"No, no," said Jimmy in a disgusted voice. "No like savage black fellow. Got a dustin' head. No tink a bit. All a gone."
"His mind wanders, being a prisoner," I stammered. "He's with the blacks, a prisoner, with my father."
"What?" cried the doctor.
"He has a fellow prisoner," I faltered. "I'm not sure. It must be my father."
"Mass Joe find 'em fodder all along," said the black. "Jimmy find 'em too."
"Be silent," cried the doctor. "Do I understand aright, Joe, that your father is a prisoner with the people from whom you have escaped?"
"Yes, I think so. I'm not sure. I feel it is so," I faltered.
"Have you seen him?"
"No," I said. "I did not know he was there until I was escaping."
"Jimmy see ums, all right ums. Find Mass Joe fodder."
"You saw him, Jimmy?" I panted.
"Is? Yes. Jimmy see him. Big long hair beard down um tummock."
"You have seen him, the prisoner?" said the doctor.
"Yes. Is Jimmy see him? Shut up all along. Sit him down. Look at ground all asleep like a wallaby.
"He means the poor fellow who helped us to escape," I said sadly.
"Jimmy see Mass Joe fodder," cried the black indignantly. "Jimmy take him right along, show him."
"The man who brought us here?"
No, cried Jimmy, dancing with vexation. Not. "Jimmy see him Mass Joe fodder sit all along. See fru hole.
Big long beard down um tummick, long hair down um back. Shake um head, so. Say, hi, hi, ho, hum. Nev see home again. Ah, my wife. Ah, my boy. You heard him say that, Jimmy? I cried, catching him by the arm. Jimmy, sure. Jimmy look through hole. Then fro little tone and hit him. Then black fellow come along, and Jimmy lay fast asleep, eye shut, no move bit. He has seen him, Joe, cried the doctor. He could not have invented that. There was a low whining growl here again from Jip, and Jack Penny drawled, I say, shan't we all be made prisoners if we stop here? Quick, said the doctor, follow me. And our guide? I cried. We must come in search of him another time. If he has been with the blacks for long, he will know how to protect himself. I was unwilling to leave one who had helped us in such a time of need, but to stay meant putting ourselves beyond being able to rescue my father, if it were really he who was our guide's fellow prisoner. The result, of course, was that I followed the doctor, while a snuffling whine now and then told us that Jip was on in front, and in spite of the darkness, leading the way so well that there seemed to be no difficulty. Where are we going? I said, after a pause, during which we had been listening to the cries of the savages, which appeared to come from several directions. To our hiding place, said the doctor. Jimmy found it before we lost him, and we have kept to it since, so as to be near you. But how did you know you were near me? I said. Through Jip, first. He went away time after time, and I suspected that he had found you. So one day we followed him, and he led us to the village. Yes, I said. Then we had to wait. I sent messages to you by him, and at last I got your answer. Tonight we were coming again, to try and reach you, perhaps get you away. We meant to try. I should not have gone back without you, my lad, he said quietly. The cries now seemed distant, and we went slowly on through the darkness. Slowly, for the trees were very close, and it required great care to avoid rushing against them. But the doctor seemed to have made himself acquainted with the forest, and he did not hesitate till all at once the shouts of the blacks seemed to come from close by upon our right, and were answered directly from behind us. A party of them have worked around, whispered the doctor. Keep cool. They cannot know we are so near. Hst! Crouch down. We were only just in time, for hardly had we crouched down close to the ground than the sound of the savages pushing forward from tree to tree was heard. I could not understand it at first, that curious tapping noise, but as they came nearer, I found that each man lightly tapped every tree he reached, partly to avoid it by the swinging of his waddy, partly as a guide to companions of his position. They came closer and closer till it seemed that they must either see or touch us, and I felt my heart beat in heavy, dull throbs as I longed for the rifle that these people had taken from me when they made me prisoner. I heard a faint rustle to my right, and I knew it was Jimmy preparing for a spring. I heard a slight sound on my left, just as the nearest savage uttered a wild cry, and I knew that this was the lock of a gun being cocked. Then all was silent once more. Perhaps the savages heard the faint click and uttered a warning, for the tapping of the trees suddenly ceased, and not the faintest sound could be heard. This terrible silence lasted quite 5 minutes. It seemed to me like an hour, and all the while we knew that at least a dozen armed savage warriors were within charging distance, and that discovery meant certain captivity, if not death. I held my breath till I felt that when I dared breathe again I should utter a loud gasp and be discovered. I dared not move to bury my face in my hands or in the soft earth, and my sensations were becoming agonizing when there was a sharp tap on a tree, so near that I felt the ground quiver. The tap was repeated to right and left accompanied by a curious cry that sounded like "Way! Why?" and the party swept on. "A narrow escape," said the doctor, as we breathed freely once more. "Go on, Gyp, let's get to Earth. We shall be safer there." I did not understand the doctor's words then, but followed in silence, with Jack Penny coming close up to me whenever he found the way open to tell me of his own affairs. "My back's a deal better," he whispered. "I've been able to rest it lately, waiting for you, and it makes it stronger, you know, and..." "Silence, Penny," said the doctor reprovingly, and Jack fell back a few feet. We travelled on till suddenly, instead of treading upon the soft, decayed leaf soil of the forest, I found that we were rustling among bushes down a steep slope. Then we were amongst loose stones, and as the darkness was not quite so dense, I made out by sight, as well as by the soft trickling sound, that a little rivulet was close to our feet. This we soon afterwards crossed, and bidding me stoop, the doctor led the way beneath the dense bushes for some little distance before we seemed to climb a stony bank, and then in the intense darkness he took me by the shoulders and backed me a few steps. "There's quite a bed of branches there," he said aloud. "You can speak out. We're safe here." And pressing me down, I sat upon the soft twigs that had been gathered together, and Jack Penny came and lay down beside me to talk for a time, and then drop off to sleep, an example I must have followed, for all at once I started and found that it was broad daylight, with a loud twittering song of birds coming from the bushes at the entrance of what seemed to be a low-roofed, extensive cave, whose mouth was in the shelving bank of a great bluff, which overhung a silvery-sounding musical stream. Some light came in from the opening, but the place was made bright by the warm glow that came from a kind of rift right at the far end of the cave, and through this was also wafted down the sweet forest scents. "Jimmy's was a lucky find for us," said the doctor, when I had partaken of the food I found they had stored there, and we had talked over our position and the probability of my belief being correct. "It is shelter as well as a stronghold," and he pointed to the means he had taken to strengthen the entrance by making our black followers bind together the branches of the tangled shrubs that grew about the mouth. In the talk that ensued, it was decided that we would wait a couple of days, then go by night and thoroughly examine the village. Jimmy would be able to point out the hut where my father was confined, and then, if opportunity served, we would bring him away, lie hidden here for a few days till the heat of the pursuit was over, then escape back to the coast. I would not own to the doctor that I had my doubts, and he owned afterwards to me that his feeling was the same. So we both acted as if we had for certain discovered him of whom we came in search, and waited our time for the first venture. It was dangerous work hunting for food at so short a distance from the village, but our black followers, aided by Jimmy, were very successful, their black skins protecting them from exciting surprise if they were seen from a distance, and they brought in a good supply of fish every day, simply by damming up some suitable pool in the little stream in whose bank our refuge was situated. This stream swarmed with fish, and it was deep down in a gully between and arched over by trees. The bows and arrows and Jimmy's spear obtained for us a few birds, and in addition they could always get for us a fair supply of fruit, though not quite such as we should have chosen had it been left to us. Roots, too, they brought, so that with the stores we had there was not much prospect of our starving. In fact, so satisfactory was our position in the pleasant, temperate cave that Jack Penny was in no hurry to move. "We're just as well here as anywhere else," he said. "That is, if we had found your father." "And got him safe here," he added, after a pause. "And the black chaps didn't come after us," he said, after a little more thought. "And your mother wasn't anxious about us," he said, after a little more consideration. "You'll find such a lot more reasons for not stopping, Jack Penny," I said, after hearing him out, "that you'll finish by saying we had better get our work done and return to a civilized country as soon as we can." "Oh, I don't know," said Jack slowly. "I don't care about civilized countries. They don't suit me. Everybody laughs at me because I'm a bit different, and father gives it to me precious hard sometimes. Give me Gyp and my gun, and I should be happy enough here." "Don't talk like that, Jack," I said in agony, as I thought of him who had helped me to escape, and of the prisoner he had mentioned, and whom the black professed to have seen. "Let's get our task done and escape as soon as we can. A savage life is not for such as we." That day we had an alarm. Our men had been out and returned soon after sunrise, that being our custom for safety's sake. Then, too, we were very careful about having a fire, though we had no difficulty with it, for it burned freely, and the smoke rose up through the great crack in the rock above our heads, and disappeared quietly amongst the trees. But we had one or two scares, hearing voices of the blacks calling to each other, but they were slight compared to the alarm to which I alluded above. The men, I say, were back, having been more successful than usual, bringing us both fish and a small wild pig. We had made a good meal, and the doctor and I were lying on the armfuls of leafy boughs that formed our couch, talking for the 20th time about our plans for the night, when, all at once, just as I was saying that with a little brave effort we could pass right through the sleepy village and bring away the prisoner, I laid my hand sharply on the doctor's arm. He raised his head at the same moment, for we had both heard the unmistakable noise given by a piece of dead twig when pressed upon by a heavy foot. We listened with beating hearts, trying to localize the very spot whence the sound came, and when we were beginning to breathe more freely it came again, but faint and distant. "Whoever it was has not found out that we are here," I whispered. The doctor nodded, and just then Jack Penny, who had been resting his back, sat up and yawned loudly, ending by giving Jimmy, who was fast asleep, a sounding slap on the back. I felt the cold perspiration ooze out of me as I glanced at the doctor. Then, turning over on my hands and knees, I crept up to where Jimmy was threatening Jack with his waddy in much anger, and held up my hand. The effect was magical. They were silent on the instant, but we passed the rest of that day in agony. "I'm glad that we decided to go tonight," the doctor said. "Whoever it was that passed must have heard us, and we shall have the savages here tomorrow to see what it meant." The night seemed as if it would never come, but at last the sun went down, and in a very short time it was dark. Our plans were to go as near as we dared to the village as soon as darkness set in, place our men, and then watch till the savages seemed to be asleep, and then, by Jimmy's help, seek out my father's prison, bring him away to the cave, and there rest for a day or two, perhaps for several, as I have said. But the events of the day had made us doubtful of the safety of our refuge, and after talking the matter over with the doctor, we both came to the conclusion that we would leave the latter part of our plan to take care of itself. "First catch your hare, Joe," said the doctor finally. "And look here, my lad, I begin to feel confident now that this prisoner is your father. We must get him away. It is not a case of try. We must, I say. And if anything happens to me..." "Happens to you?" I said, aghast. "Well, I may be captured in his place," he said, smiling. "If I am, don't wait, don't spare a moment, but get off with your prize. I don't suppose they will do more than imprison me. I am a doctor, and perhaps I can find some favor with them." "Don't talk like that, doctor," I said, grasping his hand. "We must hold together." "We must release your father," he said sternly. "There, that will do." End of chapter 31. How we made further plans. Chapter 32 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 32. How We Heard a Black Discussion and Did Not Understand. The rescue party consisted of the doctor, Ti-hi, and myself, with Jimmy for guide. Jack Penny was to take command of the cave and be ready to defend it and help us if attacked or we were pursued. At the same time, he was to have the bearers and everything in readiness for an immediate start in case we decided to continue our flight. "I think that's all we can say, Penny," said the doctor in a low, grave voice as we stood ready to start. "Everything must depend on the prisoners. Now be firm and watchful. Goodbye." "I shan't go to sleep," said Jack Penny. "I say, though, hadn't you better take Gyp?" "Yes, yes, take Gyp," I said. "He knows the way so well." "Jimmy know a way so well, too," said the black. "No take a dog, Gyp." But we decided to take the dog, and creeping down into the bed of the rivulet, we stood in the darkness, listening, shut in, as it were, by the deep silence. "Forward, Jimmy," said the doctor, and his voice sounded hollow and strange. Gyp uttered a whine. That dog had been so well trained that he rarely barked. Ran quickly up the further bank of the rivulet. Jimmy trotted after him, waddy in hand. The doctor went next. I followed, and Ti-hi brought up the rear. 1 minute the stars were shining brightly over us, the next we were under the great forest trees, and the darkness was intense. "Keep close to me, my lad," the doctor whispered, and I followed him by the ear more than by the eye. But somehow the task grew easier as we went on, and I did not once come in contact with a tree. By the way Gyp took us, I don't suppose it was more than 6 miles to the savages' village, and though we naturally went rather slowly, the excitement I felt was so great that it seemed a very little while before Jimmy stopped short to listen. "Hear 'em talk 'em, talk 'em," he whispered. We could neither of us hear a sound, but I had great faith in Jimmy's hearing, for in old times he had given me some remarkable instances of the acuteness of this sense. "Jimmy go first, see," he whispered, and the next minute we knew that we were alone with Ti-hi, Jimmy and the dog having gone on to scout. "I detest having to depend upon a savage," muttered the doctor. "It seems so degrading to a civilized man." "But they hear and see better than we do." "Yes," he said, "it is so." There we waited in that dense blackness beneath the trees, listening to the faintest sound, till quite an hour had elapsed, and we were burning to go on, when all at once Ti-hi, who was behind us, uttered a faint hiss, and as we turned sharply a familiar voice said, "All rightums, Jimmy been round round, find 'em Mass Joe fodder." "You have found him?" I cried. "Not talk shadow so," whispered Jimmy. "Black fellow come." "But have you found him?" I whispered. "Going a find 'em all soon enough," he replied coolly. "Come long now." He struck off to the right and we followed, going each moment more cautiously, for we soon heard a busy hum of many voices, a hum which soon after developed into a loud chatter with occasional angry outbursts as if something were being discussed. Jimmy went on, Gyp keeping close to his heels now, as if he quite understood the importance of not being seen. We had left the dense forest and were walking in a more open part among tall trees, beneath which it was black as ever, but outside the stars shone brilliantly, and it was comparatively light. The voices seemed so near now that I thought we were going too far, and just then Jimmy raised his hand and stopped us, before what seemed to be a patch of black darkness, and I found that we were in the shadow cast by a long hut, whose back was within a yard or so of our feet. Jimmy placed his lips close to my ear, then to the doctor's, and to each of us he whispered, "Soon go sleep, sleep, find Mass Joe fodder, and go away fast. All top here, Jimmy go see." I quite shared with the doctor the feeling of helpless annoyance at having to depend so much on the black, but I felt that he was far better able to carry out this task than we were, so stood listening to the buzz of voices that seemed now to arise on every hand. From where we stood, we could see a group of the savages standing not 30 yards from us, their presence being first made plain by their eager talking, and I pressed the doctor's arm and pointed. "Yes," he whispered, "but we are in the shadow." From huts to right and left we could hear talking, but that in front of us was silent, and I began wondering whether it was the one that had been my prison. But it was impossible to tell, everything seemed so different by the faint light cast by the stars. I could not even make out the tree where Jimmy had been tied. All at once, a sensation as of panic seized me, for the group of blacks set up a loud shout and came running towards where we were. I was sure they saw us, and with a word of warning to the doctor I turned and should have fled, but for two hands that were laid upon my shoulders pressing me down, the doctor crouching likewise. At first I thought it was Jimmy, but turning my head, I found that it was Ti-hi, whose hand now moved from my shoulder to my lips. I drew a breath full of relief the next moment, for in place of dashing down upon us, the blacks rushed into the hut behind which we were standing, crowding it, and there was nothing now but a wall of dried and interwoven palm leaves between us and our fierce enemies. Here a loud altercation seemed to ensue, angry voices being heard, and several times over I thought there was going to be a fight. I could not comprehend a word, but the tones of voices were unmistakably those of angry men, and it was easy to tell where one left off and another began. We dared not stir, for now it seemed to be so light that if we moved from the shadow of the hut we should be seen, while the fact of one of us stepping on a dead twig and making it snap would be enough to bring half the village upon us at a time when we wanted to employ strategy and not force. The burst of talking in the hut ended all at once, and there was a dead silence, as if those within were listening intently. We held our breath and listened too, trembling with excitement, for all at once we heard a voice utter a few words, and then there was a faint sound of rustling, with a cracking noise made by a joint, as if someone had risen to a standing position. Were the savages coming round to our side and about to leap upon us? Perhaps they were even then stealing from both ends, and my heart in the terrible excitement kept on a heavy, dull throb which seemed to beat right up into my throat. The moments passed away, though, and at last I began to breathe more freely. It was evident that the savages had quitted the hut. In this belief, I laid my hand upon the doctor's arm and was about to speak, when close by us, as it seemed, but really from within the wall of the hut, there came the low muttering of a voice, and I knew that someone had been left behind. The doctor pressed my hand, and I shivered as I felt how narrow an escape we had had. We wanted, of course, to move, but it seemed impossible, so we stayed, waiting to see if the black had made any discovery. After what seemed to me an interminable time I heard a slight rustling sound, and almost at the same moment there was a hand upon my arm, and directly after a warm pair of lips upon my ear. "Jimmy, no find 'em fodder yet. Take 'em out of place, put 'em somewhere. No tell." I placed my lips to his ear in turn, and whispered that there was someone left in the hut. "Jimmy, go see," he said softly, and before I could stay him, he was gone. "What is it?" whispered the doctor, and I told him. The doctor drew his pistol, I heard him in the darkness, and grasped my arm as if to be ready for flight. But just then I heard a voice in the hut which made me start with joy. Then there was a rustling sound, and Jimmy came round the corner of the hut. "All rightums," he whispered. "Find somebody's fodder." "You here again, my boy?" whispered a familiar voice. "Yes," I said, catching the speaker's arm, and then, "Doctor," I said, "this is the prisoner who saved me and set Jimmy free." "Doctor?" said the poor fellow in a low puzzled voice, as if his mind were wandering. "Yes, I am the doctor. They made me their doctor when the fever, when..." "Oh, my boy, why did you come back?" he cried excitedly, as if his brain were once more clear. "To fetch you and the other prisoner," I said. "Mr. Carstairs?" he said earnestly. "Hush, hush, they're coming back. To kill me, perhaps. I must go." He slipped away from us before we could stop him, and while we were debating as to whether we had not better rush in and fight in his defense, the savages crowded into the hut, and once more there was a loud buzz of voices. These were checked by one deeper, slower, and more stern than the others, which were silenced, and after a minute or two we heard our friend the Englishman respond in a deprecating voice and apparently plead for mercy. Then the chief savage spoke again in stern tones. There was a buzz of voices once more, and the savages seemed to file out and cross the opening toward the other side of the village. We dared not move, but remained there listening, not knowing but that a guard might have been left. But at the end of a minute or two our friend was back at our side to say excitedly, "I want to help you, but my head, I forget, I cannot speak sometimes, I cannot think, it is all dark here in my mind. Why have you come?" "We are friends," said the doctor. "Where is Mr. Carstairs?" "Carstairs? Mr. Carstairs? Oh," he began to speak volubly in the savage tongue now, tantalizing me so that I grasped his arm, exclaiming fiercely, "Speak English! Where is my father?" I could hardly see his face, but there was light enough to tell that he turned towards me, and he stopped speaking, and seemed to be endeavouring to comprehend what I said. "My father, the prisoner," I said again, with my lips now to his ear.
"Prisoner?"
"Yes, at the great hut, the chief's hut." He began speaking again, volubly, and then stopped and bent his head. "At the chief's hut?" said the doctor excitedly. "Wait a moment or two to give him time to collect himself, then ask him again." The poor dazed creature turned to the doctor now and bent towards him, holding him by the arm this time. "Chief's hut?" "Yes, right across, right there." He pointed in the direction the savages seemed to have taken, and from whence we could hear the voices rising and falling in busy speech. My heart leaped, for we knew now definitely where he whom we sought was kept, and the longing, impatient sensation there came upon me to be face to face with him was so strong I could hardly contain myself. "Let us get round there at once," I whispered. "Here, Jimmy." There was no answer. Jimmy had crept away. End of chapter 32. How we heard a black discussion and did not understand.
Chapter 33 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 33. How I Nearly Made a Terrible Mistake. We tried several times over to get our friend to speak, but the result was only a voluble burst of words in a tongue we could not comprehend, while all the time he seemed to be aware of his failing, and waved his hands and stretched them out to us, as if begging us to forgive him for his weakness. "Let him be, Joe," whispered the doctor at last. "We may excite him by pressing him. Let him calm himself, and then perhaps he can speak." I felt as if it was resigning myself to utter despair, and it seemed that our attempt that night was to be in vain, when Jimmy suddenly popped up among us once more. "Long here," he whispered, and we were about to follow him when our friend stopped us. "No, this way," he said, and he pointed in the opposite direction. "No, no, long here way," said Jimmy excitedly. "Much lot black fellow that way." "Never mind," I whispered, "let's follow him." "Jimmy find Mass Joe fodder right long this way," cried the black. "Not go long other way." "Where is my father?" "Big hut over cross," said Jimmy. "Let's get round this way to it then," I whispered. "Come along." The doctor was already in advance, following our guide, and after striking the earth a heavy blow with his waddy to get rid of his anger, Jimmy followed me, not able to understand that we could get to the opposite point by going round one way as readily as by the other. It was very slow work, and we had to labor hard, holding the bushes and trees so that they should not fly back upon those who followed us. But by dint of great care, we got round at last to what, as far as I could judge, was the far side of the village, our principal guide being the sound of voices, which came to us in a dull murmur that increased as we grew nearer. And at last we found ourselves similarly situated as to position, being at the back of another large hut. Here we waited, listening to the buzz of voices, till I wondered in my impatience what they could be discussing, and longed to ask our guide, but feared lest I should confuse him, now that perhaps he was about to do us good service if left alone. I was glad that I had kept quiet the next minute, for the doctor laid his hand upon my shoulder and whispered in my ear, "There is no doubt about it, my lad. We have reached the right spot. Your father is a prisoner in this very hut, and the savages are discussing whether they will keep him here or take him away." "What shall we do?" I whispered back in agony, for it seemed so terrible to have come all these hundreds of miles to find him, and then to sit down, as it were, quite helpless, without taking a step to set him free. "We can do nothing yet," he replied, "but wait for an opportunity to get him away." "Can you not make some plan?" I whispered back. "Psst!" He pressed my hand, for I had been growing louder of speech in my excitement, and just then there was a fresh outburst of voices from within the hut, followed by the trampling of feet and loud shouting, which seemed to be crossing the village and going farther away. "They have taken the prisoner to—" Our companion said the first words excitedly, and then stopped short. "Where?" I exclaimed aloud, as I caught at his arm. He answered me in the savage tongue, and with an impatient stamp of the foot I turned to the doctor. "What can we do?" I said. "It makes me wish to be a prisoner too. I should see him, perhaps, and I could talk to him and tell him that help was near." "While you shut up part of the help, and raised expectations in his breast that would perhaps result in disappointment," replied the doctor, "we must wait, my lad, wait. The savages are excited and alarmed, and we must come when their suspicions are at rest." "What do you mean?" I said. "Do you mean to go back tonight without him?" "Not if we can get him away," he said, "but we must not do anything mad or rash." "No, no, of course not," I said despairingly. "But this is horrible, to be so close to him and yet able to do nothing." "Be patient, my lad," he whispered, "and speak lower. We have done wonders. We have come into this unknown wild, and actually have found that the lost man is alive. What is more, we have come, as if led by blind instinct, to the very place where he is a prisoner, and we almost know the hut in which he is confined." "Yes, yes, I know all that," I said, "but it is so hard not to be able to help him now." "We are helping him," said the doctor. "Just think, we have this poor, half-dazed fellow to glean some information, and we have a hiding place near, and look out!" I turned my piece in the direction of the danger, for just then a member of our little expedition, who had been perfectly silent so far, uttered a strange growl and a fierce, worrying noise. Simultaneously there was a burst of shouts and cries, with the sound of blows and the rush of feet through the bush. For the next few minutes there was so much excitement and confusion that I could hardly tell what happened in the darkness. All I knew was that a strong clutch was laid upon my shoulders, and that I was being dragged backwards, when I heard the dull thud of a blow and I was driven to the ground, with a heavy body lying across me. I partly struggled out of this position, partly found myself dragged out, and then, in a half-stunned, confused fashion, I yielded as I was dragged through the dark forest, the twigs and boughs lashing my face horribly. I had kept tight hold of my gun, and with the feeling strong upon me that if I wished to avoid a second captivity I must free myself, I waited for an opportunity to turn upon the strong savage who held me so tightly in his grasp and dragged me through the bush in so pitiless a manner. He had me with his left hand riveted in my clothes, while with his right hand, I presumed with a war club, he dashed the bushes aside when the obstacles were very great. My heart beat fast, as I felt that if I were to escape, I must fire at this fierce enemy, and so horrible did the act seem that twice over, after laying my hand upon my pistol, I withdrew it, telling myself that I had better wait for a few minutes longer. And so I waited, feeling that, after all, my captivity would not be so bad as it was before, seeing that now I should know my father was near at hand. "I can't shoot now," I said to myself passionately. "I don't think I'm a coward, but I cannot fire at the poor wretch, and I must accept my fate." My arm dropped to my side, and at that moment my captor stopped short. "No hear 'em come long now," he said. "Jimmy," I cried, and for a moment the air seemed full of humming, singing noises, and if I had not clung to my companion, I should have fallen. End of chapter 33. Chapter 34 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 34. How Jimmy and I Were Hunted Like Beasts. "Jimmy," I panted, as soon as I had recovered myself, to find that the black was feeling me all over in the darkness. "Not got no knock'em chops, no waddy bang, no popgun ball in 'em nowhere," he whispered. "No, Jimmy, I'm not wounded," I said. "I thought you were one of the black fellows." "No, no black fellow, no common black fellow, savage," he said importantly. "Come long fast, fast." "But the doctor and the prisoner tie high," I said. "All run way much fast," said Jimmy. "Jip, jip, see black fellow come long much, for Jimmy do, and nibblin' legs make 'em hard, hard. Gib one, two, topper, topper, den Jimmy say, time 'em way, take Mass Joe, come long." "But we must go and help the doctor," I said. "Can't find 'em. All go long back to big hole, hide 'em, say Mass Joe come back long o' Jimmy Jimmy." It seemed probable that they would make for our hiding place, but I was very reluctant to go and leave my friends in the lurch, so I detained Jimmy, and we sat listening, the black making me sit down. "Rest 'em leg'ems," he said, "run much fast den." We stayed there listening for what must have been the space of half an hour, and during that time we could hear the shouting and rapping of trees of the blacks, as they were evidently searching the bush. But there was no sound of excitement or fighting, neither did it seem to me that there were any exulting shouts, such as might arise over the capture of prisoners. This gave me hope, and in the belief that I might find my companions at the hiding-place I was about to propose to Jimmy, that we would go on, when he jumped up. "No stop no longer. Black fellow come along fast. Get away." The noises made by the blacks were plainly coming nearer, and I sprang to my feet, trying to pierce the darkness. But everywhere there were the dimly seen shapes of trees so close that they almost seemed to lower, and their branches to bear down upon our heads. There was the fresh, moist scent of the dewy earth and leaves, and now and then a faint cry of some bird, but nothing to indicate the way we ought to go. I turned to Jimmy. "Can you tell where the cave is?" I said. "No, Jimmy all dark," he answered. "Can't you tell which way to go?" "Oh, yes'm," he whispered. "Jimmy know which way go." "Well, which?" I said, as the shouts came nearer. "Dat away where no black fellow." "But it may be away from the cave," I said. "Jimmy don't know. Can't help along. Find cave morrow, next day." There was wisdom in his proposal, which, awkwardly as it was shaped, meant that we were to avoid the danger now and find our friends another time. "Mass Joe, keep long close," he whispered. "Soon come near time see a long way Mass Doctor and Mass Jack Pennypenny." We paused for a moment, the black going down on his knees to lay his head close to the ground, so as to make sure of the direction where the savages were, and he rose up with anything but comfortable news. "All round bout nearer, come long other way." Just then I gave a jump, for something touched my leg through a great rent in my trousers. It felt cold, and for the moment I thought it must be the head of a serpent. But a low familiar whine undeceived me, and I stooped down to pat the neck of Jack Penny's shaggy friend. "Home, Jip," I said, "home." He understood me and started off at once, fortunately in the direction taken by Jimmy, and after a long toilsome struggle through the bush, the more arduous from the difficulty we experienced in keeping up with the dog, we at last reached a gully at the bottom of which we could hear the trickling of water. "All right'ems," said Jimmy quickly, and plunging down through the bushes, he was soon at the bottom, and went upon his knees to find out which way the stream ran. He jumped up directly, having found that by the direction the water ran, we must be below the cave, always supposing that this was the right stream. Down in the gully the sounds of pursuit grew very faint, and at last died out, while we waded at times, and at others found room upon the shelving bank to get along, perhaps for 100 yards unchecked, then would come a long stretch where the gully was full of thick bushes, and here our only chance was to creep under them, wading the while in the little stream, often with our bodies bent so that our faces were close to the water. Jip trotted cheerfully on as I plashed through the water, stopping from time to time to utter a low whine to guide us when he got some distance ahead. And I often envied the sagacious animal his strength and activity, for beside him at a time like this I seemed to be a very helpless creature indeed. Two or three times over I grasped the black's arm, and we stopped to listen, for it seemed to me that I could hear footsteps and the rustling of the bushes at the top of the gully far above our heads. But whenever we stopped the noise ceased, and feeling at last that it was fancy, I plodded on, till, half dead with fatigue, I sank down on my knees and drank eagerly of the cool fresh water, both Jimmy and the dog following my example. At last, though I should not have recognized the place in my gloom, Jimmy stopped short, and from the darkness above my head, as I stood with the stream bubbling past my legs, I heard the unmistakable click of a gun cock. "Jack!" I whispered. "Jack Penny!" "That'll do," he whispered back. "Come along. All right. Have you got him?" "Whom?" I said, stumbling painfully up into the cave, where I threw myself down. "Your father." "No," I said dismally, "and we've lost the doctor and Ti-hi. Poor fellows, I'm afraid they are taken. But, Jack Penny, we are right. My father is a prisoner in the village." "Then we'll go and fetch him out, and the doctor too. Ti-hi can take care of himself. I'd as soon expect to keep a snake in a wicker cage as that fellow in these woods. But come, tell us all about it." I partook, with a sensation as if choking all the while, of the food he had waiting, and then, as we sat there waiting for the day in the hope that the doctor might come, I told Jack Penny the adventures of the night. Jimmy playing an accompaniment the while upon his nose. End of chapter 34.
Chapter 35 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 35. How Jack Penny Fired a Straight Shot. There was no stopping Jimmy's snoring. Pokes and kicks only intensified the noise, so at last we let him lie, and I went on in a doleful key to the end. "Oh, it ain't so very bad after all," said Jack Penny in his slow drawl. "I call it a good night's work." "Good, Jack?" "Yes, well, ain't it?" he drawled. "While you've got back safe, and you don't know that the doctor won't get back, and you've done what you came to do, you've found your father." "But suppose, Jack Penny," I said, They do him some injury for what has passed." "'Tain't likely," drawled Jack. "They've kept him all this time. Why should they want to, well, kill him, if that's what you're afraid of now?" "Yes," I said sadly. "Gammon, 'tain't likely. If you'd got an old kangaroo in a big cage, and the young kangaroo came and tried to get him away, you wouldn't go and kill the old kangaroo for it." "No, no," I said. "Of course not. I didn't mean to call your father an old kangaroo, Joe Carstairs. I only meant it to be an instance, like. I say, do kick that fellow for snoring so." "It is of no use to kick him, poor fellow, and besides, he's tired. He's a good fellow, Jack." "Yes, I suppose he is," said Jack Penny, "but he's awfully black." "Well, he can't help that." "And he shines so," continued Jack in tones of disgust. "I never saw a black fellow with such shiny skin. I say, though, didn't you feel in a stew, Joe Carstairs, when you thought it was a black fellow lugging you off?" "I did," I said, "and when, afterwards, hist, is that anything?" We gazed through the bushes at the darkness outside, and listened intently, but there was no sound save Jimmy's heavy breathing, and I went on. "When afterwards I found it was the black, I turned queer and giddy. Perhaps it was the effect of the blow I got, but I certainly felt as if I should faint. I didn't know I was so girlish." Jack Penny did not speak for a few minutes, and I sat thinking bitterly of my weakness as I stroked Jip's head, the faithful beast having curled up between us and laid his head upon my lap. I seemed to have been so cowardly, and weary and dejected as I was, I wished that I had grown to be a man, with a man's strength and indifference to danger. "Oh, I don't know," said Jack Penny suddenly. "Don't know what?" I said sharply, as he startled me out of my thinking fit. "Oh, about being girlish and well, cowardly, I suppose you mean." "Yes, cowardly," I said bitterly. "I thought I should be so brave, and that when I had found where my father was, I should fight and bring him away from among the savages." "Ah, yes," said Jack Penny dryly, "that's your sort. That's like what you read in books and papers about boys of 15 and 16 and 17. They're wonderful chaps who take young women in their arms and then jump on horseback with them and gallop off at full speed. Some of 'em have steel coats like lobsters on, and heavy helmets, and that makes it all the easier. I've read about some of them chaps who wielded their swords. They never swing 'em about and chop and stab with 'em, but wield 'em, and they kill 3 or 4 men every day and think nothing of it. I used to swallow all that stuff, but I'm not such a guffin now." There was a pause here, while Jack Penny seemed to be thinking. "Why, some of these chaps swim across rivers with a man under their arm, and if they're on horseback they sing out a battle cry and charge into a whole army, and everybody's afraid of 'em. I say, ain't it jolly nonsense, Joe Carstairs?" "I suppose it is," I said sadly, for I had believed in some of these heroes, too. "I don't believe the boy ever lived who didn't feel in an awful stew when he was in danger. Why, men do at first before they get used to it. There was a chap came to our place last year and did some sheep-herding for father about 6 months. He'd been a soldier out in the Crimean War and got wounded twice in the arm and in the leg, big wounds, too. He told me that when they got the order to advance, him and his mates, they were all of a tremble, and the officers looked as pale as could be, some of 'em. But every man tramped forward steady enough, and it wasn't till they began to see their mates drop that the want to fight began to come. They felt savage, he says, then, and as soon as they were in the thick of it, there wasn't a single man felt afraid. We sat in silence for a few minutes, and then he went on again. If men feel afraid sometimes, I don't see why boys shouldn't. And as to those chaps who go about in books killing men by the dozen, and never feeling to mind it a bit, I think it's all gammon. "Hiss, Jack Penny, what's that?" I whispered. There was a faint crashing noise out in the forest just then, and I knew from the sound close by me that the black who was sharing our watch must have been lifting his spear. I picked up my gun, and I knew that Jack had taken up his and thrown himself softly into a kneeling position, as we both strove to pierce the darkness and catch sight of what was perhaps a coming enemy. As we watched, it seemed as if the foliage of the trees high up had suddenly come into view. There was a gray look in the sky, and for the moment I thought I could plainly make out the outline of bushes on the opposite side of the gully. Then I thought I was mistaken, and then again it seemed as if I could distinctly see the outline of a bush. A minute later, and with our hearts beating loudly, we heard the rustling go on, and soon after we could see that the bushes were being moved. "It is the doctor," I thought, but the idea was false, I knew, for if it had been he, his way would have been down into the stream, which he would have crossed, while whoever this was seemed to be undecided and had to be gazing about intently, as if in search of something. When we first caught a glimpse of the moving figure, it was 50 yards away. Then it came to within 40, went off again, and all the time the day was rapidly breaking. The treetops were plainly to be seen, and here and there one of the great masses of foliage stood out quite clearly. Just then the black, who had crept close to my side, pointed out the figure on the opposite bank, now dimly seen in the transparent dawn. It was that of an Indian who had stopped exact opposite the clump of bushes which acted as a screen to our place of refuge, and stooping down he was evidently trying to make out the mouth of the cave. He saw it, apparently, for he uttered a cry of satisfaction, and leaping from the place of observation he stepped rapidly down the slope. "He has found us out," I whispered. "But he mustn't come, all the same," said Jack Penny, and as he spoke I saw that he was taking aim. "Don't shoot!" I cried, striking at his gun, but I was too late, for as I bent towards him he drew the trigger. There was a flash, a puff of smoke, a sharp retort that echoed from the mouth of the cave, and then, with a horrible dread upon me, I sprang up and made for the entrance, followed by Jack and the blacks. It took us but a minute to get down into the stream-bed and then to climb up amongst the bushes to where we had seen the savage, and neither of us now gave a thought of there being danger from his companions. What spirit moved Jack Penny I cannot tell. That which moved me was an eager desire to know whether a horrible suspicion was likely to be true, and to gain the knowledge I proceeded on first till I reached the spot where the man had fallen. It was a desperate venture, for he might have struck at me, wounded merely, with war-club or spear. But I did not think of that. I wanted to solve the horrible doubt, and I had just caught sight of the fallen figure lying prone upon its face when Jimmy uttered a warning cry, and we all had to stoop down amongst the bushes, for it seemed as if the savage's companions were coming to his help. End of chapter 35.
Chapter 36 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 36. How the Doctor Found a Patient Ready to His Hand. We waited for some minutes crouched there among the bushes, listening to the coming of those who forced their way through the trees, while moment by moment the morning light grew clearer, the small birds twittered, and the parrots screamed. We could see nothing, but it was evident that two, if not three, savages were slowly descending the slope of the ravine towards where we were hidden. The wounded man uttered a low groan that thrilled me and then sent a cold shudder through my veins, for I was almost touching him, and set aside the feeling of horror at having been, as it were, partner in inflicting his injury, there was the sensation that he might recover sufficiently to revenge himself upon us by a blow with his spear. The sounds came nearer, and it was now so light that as we watched we could see the bushes moving, and it seemed to me that more of this horrible bloodshed must ensue. We were crouching close, but the wounded man was moaning, and his companions might at any moment hear him, and then discovery must follow. While if, on the other hand, we did not resist, all hope of rescuing my poor father would be gone. "We must fight," I said to myself, setting my teeth hard and bringing my gun to bear on the spot where I could see something moving. At the same time I tried to find where Jack Penny was hiding, but he was out of sight. At the risk of being seen I rose up a little so as to try and get a glimpse of the coming enemy, but though the movement among the bushes was plain enough I only caught one glimpse of a black body, and had I been disposed to shoot it was too quick for me and was gone in an instant. They were coming nearer, and in an agony of excitement I was thinking of attempting to back away and try to reach the cave, when I felt that I could not get Jack Penny and the black to act with me unless I showed myself, and this meant revealing our position, and there all the time were the enemy steadily making their way right towards us. "What shall I do?" I said to myself as I realized in a small way what must be the feelings of a general who finds that the battle is going against him. "I must call to Jack Penny." "Cooey!" rang out just then from a little way to my right, and Jimmy looked up from his hiding place. "Is Carstairs there?" cried the familiar voice of the doctor, and as with beating heart I sprang up, he came staggering wearily towards me through the clinging bushes. "My dear boy," he cried, with his voice trembling, "what I have suffered on your account! I thought you were a prisoner." "No," I exclaimed, delighted at this turn in our affairs. "Jimmy helped me to escape. I say, you don't think I ran away and deserted you?" "My dear boy," he cried, "I was afraid that you would think this of me. But there, thank heaven, you are safe. And though we have not rescued your father, we know enough to make success certain." "I'm afraid not," I said hastily. "The savages have discovered our hiding place." "No!" "Yes, and one of them was approaching it just now when Jack Penny shot him down." "This is very unfortunate. Where? What? Close here?" I had taken his hand to lead him to the clump of bushes where the poor wretch lay, and on parting the boughs and twigs we both started back in horror. "My boy, what have you done?" cried the doctor as I stood speechless there by his side. "We have not so many friends that we could afford to kill them." But already he was busy, feeling the folly of wasting words, and down upon his knees, to place the head of our friend, the prisoner of the savages, in a more comfortable position before beginning to examine him for his wound. "Bullet, right through the shoulder," said the doctor in a short, abrupt manner. And as he spoke he rapidly tore up his handkerchief and plugged and bound the wound, supplementing the handkerchief with the long scarf which he wore round the waist. "Now, Teehee, Jimmy, help me carry him to the cave." "Jimmy carry him all long right way, put him on Jimmy's back," cried my black companion, and this seeming to be no bad way of carrying the wounded man in such a time of emergency, Jimmy stooped down, exasperating me the while by grinning, as if it was good fun, till the sufferer from our mistake was placed upon his back, when he exclaimed, "Lot much heavy, twice two sheep heavy, clear de bush." We hastily drew the boughs aside, and Jimmy steadily descended the steep slope, entered the rivulet, crossed, and then stopped for a moment beneath the overhanging boughs before climbing to the cabin. "Here, let me help you," said the doctor, holding out his hand. "Yes," said Jimmy, drawing his waddy and boomerang from his belt. "Hold 'em tight, I'm all in blackfellow way." Then, seizing the boughs, he balanced the wounded man carefully, and drew himself steadily up step by step, exhibiting wonderful strength of muscle, till he had climbed to the entrance of the cave, where he bent down and crawled in on hands and knees, waiting till his burden was removed from his back, and then getting up once more to look round smiling. "Jimmy carry lot of men like that way." We laid the sufferer on one of the beds of twigs that the savages had made for us, and here the doctor set himself to work to more securely bandage his patient's shoulder. Jack Penny looking on, resting upon his gun and wearing a countenance full of misery. "There," said the doctor when he had finished, "I think he will do now. 2 inches lower, Master Penny, and he would have been a dead man." "I couldn't help it," drawled Jack Penny. "I thought he was a savage coming to kill us. I'm always doing something. There was never such an unlucky chap as I am." "Oh, you meant what you did for the best," said the doctor, laying his hand on Jack Penny's shoulder. "What did he want to look like a savage for?" grumbled Jack. "Who was going to know that anyone dressed up, no, I mean dressed down, like that was an Englishman?" "It was an unfortunate mistake, Penny. You must be more careful if you mean to handle a gun." "Here, take it away," said Jack Penny bitterly. "I won't fire it off again." "I was very nearly making the same mistake," I said, out of compassion for Jack Penny. He seemed so much distressed. "I had you and Teehee covered in turn as you came up, Doctor." "Then I'm glad you did not fire," he said. "There, keep your peace, Penny. We may want its help. As for your friend here, he has a painful wound, but I don't think any evil will result from it. Hist, he is coming too." Our conversation had been carried on in a whisper, and we now stopped short and watched the doctor's patient in the dim twilight of the cavern, as he unclosed his eyes and stared first up at the ceiling and then about him, till his eyes rested upon us, when he smiled. "Am I much hurt?" he said, in a low, calm voice. "Oh no," said the doctor, "a bullet wound, not a dangerous one at all." To my astonishment, he went on talking quite calmly, and without any of the dazed look and the strange habit of forgetting his own tongue to continue in that of the people among whom he had been a prisoner for so long. "I thought I should find you here," he said, "and I came on, thinking that perhaps I could help you." "Help us? Yes, of course you can. You shall help us to get Mr. Carstairs away." "Poor fellow, yes," he said softly, and in so kindly a way that I crept closer and took his hand. "We tried several times to escape, but they overtook us and treated us so hard that of late we had grown resigned to our fate." I exchanged glances with the doctor, who signed to me to be silent. "It was a very hard one, very hard," the wounded man continued, and then he stopped short, looking straight before him at the forest, seen through the opening of the cave. By degrees his eyelids dropped, were raised again, and then fell, and he seemed to glide into a heavy sleep. The doctor motioned us to keep away, and we all went to the mouth of the cave, to sit down and talk over the night's adventure, the conversation changing at times to a discussion of our friend's mental affection. "The shock of the wound has affected his head beneficially, it seems," the doctor said at last. "Whether it will last, I cannot say." At least it seemed to me that the doctor was saying those or similar words from out of a mist, and then all was silent. The fact was that I had been out all night, exerting myself tremendously, and I had now fallen heavily asleep. End of chapter 36. Recording by Tim McKenzie.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.